and trade Jaime Lannister for Sansa and Arya.
Of course. Yes. We could just trade the king's slayer and get the girls back.
Oh, Rob, you mean
it? Of course I don't mean it, you crazy woman!
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started, all engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
And welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined this week by John Ringer. Welcome aboard, John.
Thanks, Van. Thanks for having me.
John is my longtime writing and now podcasting partner for the War Eagle Reader and our Wishbone podcast, but he joins me here on the White Rocket Show this week to discuss a topic near and dear to both of us, George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, or as it's known to the TV viewers, Game of Thrones. And no A on there, oddly, just Game of Thrones. HBO could only afford 3 words for the title. They had a jettison at the beginning. So as by way of introduction, John, why don't we start out first I guess we should warn the listeners that we're going to give some spoilers out, right? What is your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought is, if you have not read all the books or watched all the TV shows, if you're planning to, turn it off and download it and listen to it after you've done that. Because we, in order to do this podcast, we're going to need to talk about things that happened in all the books, you know, which characters died and that kind of stuff, but also everything that's happened in the TV show, mm-hmm. the differences between the books and the TV show. So if you haven't caught up, you know, and you love the series, I don't want to spoil things for you because I think it's too good. And one of the things I really hate is people spoiling stuff for me. So I would just warn you to download it, save it after you finish everything, read it, and then let us know what you think.
Cool. So you have been warned. Now let us proceed. This is a pretty popular series. I don't know, you know, it was fairly popular with some of the crowd that at least I pal around with on the internet, you know, as far back as 13 or 14 years ago. I guess it started really back in the mid-90s, if not the early 90s. And we're going to talk in just a second about kind of how each of us found out about it and came to it and all that. But what is it that makes this series so popular, do you think, with readers and now with viewers?
I think there's a couple things that make the series so popular. One of the first is that Martin is clearly not afraid to kill a major character. And because of that, you don't know which characters are going to live and which characters are going to die. And in other books and other series, you read it and there's two or three main characters and you know that no matter how preposterous a situation they get in, they're going to survive. Mm-hmm. And with George R. R. Martin, he's not afraid to kill that person. I mean, do not assume that any character in this series, you become real attached to them. And the other part of that is by telling it in a first person point of view from those characters, you become attached to those characters. You become sympathetic to them. You like them. You know, people really like Jon Snow. People like Arya Stark. We want them to survive. They might not. And that's really hard for people to deal with. So that's one thing. And then also just the level of sophistication of kind of the treachery and plotting against each other is really good. I think it's really well done. It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you really feel like people are playing kind of a no-holds-barred, vicious game to rule this kingdom.
Yeah, it's almost like watching a NASCAR race, and you're rooting for a certain two or three cars, and cars are crashing every lap, you know?
Yes, exactly right.
and you don't know exactly how many laps there are to go, thanks to Martin sort of moving the finish line repeatedly. He claims now, I guess, what, 7 books are going to do it?
Yes.
Originally it was going to be 3, and then it was going to be more than that. Now it's 7. And of course he's had to break some books in half. We'll talk about that in a minute. So there have been things that have happened along the way that have moved the finish line, you know, moved the goal line, as they say. So we're just hoping that somebody we know and care about is still alive to get to the finish line.
You were talking about how we came to this series. I guess one of my buddies that I used to live a long time ago in Mississippi, and one of my buddies there was a big reader like us, and he grabbed a hold of this series when it first came out in 96, and he read it, and he knew that I would enjoy it. He told me, hey, you need to get a hold of this and start reading it, and I started reading it, and, you know, about the time I came to Virginia in 2000, the books were becoming, you know, more popular. He was just on the second book, heading into the third book. And at that point, you know, I was telling, you know, when I talked to other people that I knew would enjoy it, I was kind of spreading the word. Hey, you, this is really, really, really good stuff. You need to read this. And I've, you know, read every book the day it came out since then. And I've probably read the entire series, you know, at least 5 times. And we'll watch the TV show. I was so excited when they announced that HBO was going to do the TV show. And I, because it's the one network that could do it the way it needed to be done, and I've enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to season 3 in a couple weeks.
Yeah, that's the truth. You know, we always say if a project that we enjoy, and I mean you, me, or any various people who feel the same way we do about various properties, we always want it to be an HBO series. You know, because with an HBO series, you're going to get something more sophisticated than a network show or something. You'll get something almost or about as sophisticated as a feature film, but you get a lot more of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you get hours of it rather than just 2 hours or 3 hours and you're done. So, yeah, it was very exciting. And really, I think HBO was the only way this show could be done because it's too adult for network television. It's probably too expensive for like a, you know, FX or AMC type of channel, which do good shows, but nothing this just super sophisticated and
nothing this epic.
Yeah. Epic, right. And if you had done it as movies, you just wouldn't have had enough room. There just wouldn't have been enough time to get all the layers of characters and story in, I don't think.
That's right.
Yeah, I came to it about the same time as you. Now there's 3 things I just came up with. There's 3 things I want to kind of compare it to and get your thoughts on before we go further, okay?
Okay.
Now, when you talk about when we came to the book, let me tell my side, and then I'll and that segues me into number 1 here. I came to it about the year 2000 or 2001, somewhere in there, when the first 2, A Game of Thrones and A Clash of Kings, were out in paperback, really thick paperback, and A Storm of Swords had just come out in hardback, and various people that I knew on the internet had told me they found one person in particular found I believe it was Mark Ballou, longtime Avengers buddy of mine, found just the right key to unlock it for me. He said it's Babylon 5 meets Lord of the Rings. And I said, ooh, you certainly found the way to motivate me. And so, and I kind of see, I, you know, immediately saw what he meant in a certain way, that it, Babylon 5 in the sense that people lived and died, and it was, like you said, there was no predicting who was going to survive, and things change constantly. It's not predictable in that way. And Lord of the Rings I'll get to in just a second. But first, you also mentioned coming into it 3 books in like me, right?
Yes.
Now, the other big epic 7-volume series, and one that I talked about with David Wright in episode 2 of this series, was The Dark Tower by Stephen King. Now, with they both have something in common, which is it's taken a long time to get the story out, and some people have been long-suffering. But see, with The Dark Tower, I didn't start reading it until the 7th book came out. I didn't even know hardly that it existed until the last 3 big volumes came out and there was kind of a media push. And I was very grateful because, as David and I talked about, if you started reading with the 3rd volume of The Dark Tower, it ends with one of the biggest cliffhangers in literature, and you were left for like 10 years.
Oh, it was more than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was like 25 years, I think.
Well, I mean, between the third and fourth book.
I think it was really long.
Just for that, okay. Well, and that wouldn't surprise you. So,
and so those, I mean, if that had been me, if you and I had been in the situation, and I had been left with that cliffhanger where they're on Blaine the train and
yeah.
left hanging, I'd have driven to Maine and beaten up Stephen King myself.
I think some people threatened to do that, and his answer was, "I don't know what's going to happen, so I can't tell you." But see, with this one, we kind of don't have that advantage. We came into it fairly early, and I think the first three books came out fairly quickly, relatively speaking. Whereas, after the 2001 or 2001, Volume 4 came out in 2006 when I moved to Illinois, and Volume 7 came out only like about a year or two ago, right? So he's really slowed down even from the pace he had before.
Which was glacial.
Yes, right. So that's one comparison. I don't think there's much similarity other than in terms of beloved characters dying, and it's kind of fantasy related, but they both have taken a long time to get going, and the readers are about to pull our hair out. The second thing I wanted to compare it to and to get your feelings on is Tolkien. They're both fantasy epics, but where would you draw any sort of comparison beyond that basic fact?
I think the one thing that really strikes me about both series that makes it an interesting comparison is the use of magic,
mm-hmm.
where both of them, there is magic, it's there, it does stuff, but it's very sparse. It's not, Harry Potter all the time, somebody snaps their fingers and something happens. It's few and far between, and you don't know who has it and what's going to work. And so I think that part, it's in the world and it can do stuff, but it's not everywhere. I think that really adds something to both of them, just in the sparseness of how they used it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think both, kind of the epic scope of both of them, too, trying to do something really huge.
Yeah. Well, I think that the readers probably, and our listeners should probably understand, though, that Lord of the Rings was built around one goal, one task. There was a bad thing, the ring and Sauron, and they had to do something about it, the end.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this doesn't really have one objective, does it? I mean,
there's one objective, it's rule the kingdom.
Right, exactly. But even then, I mean, some of the contenders are already gone, So,
sure.
If there's one sort of major threat, it's the people north of the wall and the ice zombies or whatever, but even they have always been kind of an amorphous, vague, threat. If you watch the TV show, they've only showed up a couple of times in, three seasons of the show. And that it was that way through the first four books that they rarely ever show up. Like you say, the magic and even the menace is so sparse, the supernatural menace.
Yes.
So, okay, and the third thing I wanted to compare it to, because this was very strong to me, especially the first book, being a history guy, is The Wars of the Roses.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any doubt that he started out with The Wars of the Roses as at least sort of the template for his kingdoms?
No, it's the perfect parallel because it's, multiple families, different potential heirs,
mm-hmm.
People in power grabbing the heirs and using them or claiming themselves king, and it really is a good parallel.
Even to the name, the Starks and the Lannisters might as well be the Yorks and the Lancasters, And the funny thing about that is, I came to the Wars of the Roses through Shakespeare's Henry VI. When I was a kid, I saw a really nice BBC production of it, and it even had Bernard Hill from Lord of the Rings as one of the, one of the guys and one of the royalty. And I was if you read or see a performance of Henry VI, you're gonna like the Yorks. This was before I had seen Henry V and saw that the Lancasters could be good too, And so I was a big York fan, and I read the first, I read A Game of Thrones, and sure enough, the Starks are ostensibly the good guys. Some would say too good for their own good, right? And sure. And the Lancasters, the Lannisters, are the bad guys, at least initially, although we come to like some of them better as time goes by. So, yeah, it's just fascinating how he sort of started out with that real historical thing and then starts adding in, you know, other kingdoms, adds in fantasy plots and fantasy concepts and everything, too. Like the when the dragons finally show up, you're kind of like, holy crap, there really are dragons, you know?
Yep.
Now, you mentioned the structure that Martin uses and said a little bit about it. What he does is he uses that third-person limited point of view that is very popular right now. And as a writer, I kind of chafe at being expected to write in one specific way all the time. But I like that he kind of defies convention in a way, because while he does use third-person limited, he changes it every chapter. And what does it do to the reader, John, in your opinion, when he, by changing that point of view every chapter?
Well, I mean, for one, it's too big and too epic a series mm-hmm. to be told from a single point of view of one person with their limited knowledge of events in the world. So you either have to do some kind of bigger perspective and update the reader of what's happening in different places, or you have to do what he does and have multiple characters. But the other thing that's really nice is those characters have limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
They're constantly struggling to figure out what's going on in the world. And they only know what's going on in the little patch of the world they can see and get information about. So you, the reader, are also left wondering what's going on in other parts of the world. And because he skips from person to person, and then also the time is moving forward in all these different places, you know, things happen. Important events happen that are only vaguely referred to in the books. He doesn't try to chronicle every single thing that happens. He says, "Oh yeah, we're back to this person, and while you were gone, there was a battle." And so, I think that's really useful. But also, by telling it from their perspective, you get their feelings and their thoughts, and you come to understand them as a person and like them as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like how you're talking about with some of the Lannisters. I mean, Tyrion Lannister is a great, great character. And you come to really, really appreciate him over the series, the way he looks at the world and how he deals with stuff. And even Jaime Lannister, you hate his guts in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
He's the kid. He's the guy who threw a kid out of the tower because he was having sex with his sister. And but over the course of the series, you see, you know, kind of his view of himself in the world, and you come to appreciate him as a person. So I think it's really smart how he's done it. And also, it creates this kind of fog of, you know, war kind of thing where people don't know what else is going on in the world, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And Martin doesn't try to spell it all out.
Mm.
There's a lot of, you know, you don't know. And that's a good thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, as they call him, really is he's the perfect example, because Tyrion, from the very beginning, is at least likable. And it doesn't hurt that he doesn't like the rest of his family. So at the beginning, you're not liking the Lannisters because you're mostly getting the Stark point of view. But he doesn't like the Lannisters either, right?
So he's a dwarf, so you feel bad for him. You like him.
Yeah, and he uses his clever, you know. Yeah. I mean, the actor in the show, which we'll get to in a bit, really is just fantastic at kind of capturing that. I think that's the most successful thing the show has done, and it's done a lot of things successful. But Jaime, on the other hand, is just a jerk from the very beginning. Everything you read about him from everybody else's point of view, everybody hates him, everybody calls him names, even though he's like the most popular, best-looking kid. You know, it's really interesting.
Yep.
He's like the guy that in other circumstances would have been, you know, the homecoming king, you know, the quarterback, the captain of the football team, you know, but yet he's done some things that people have turned that into kind of resentment and dislike. And certainly when you're getting the point of view of the Starks about him, you hate him. But then, yeah, somewhere like in where, like book two or book three, suddenly you get Jaime chapters from his point of view.
Yep.
And you get about halfway through and you're like, yeah, Jaime's pretty cool. And you're like, wait a minute. Jaime's pretty cool. I thought I was supposed to hate this guy. So that when that happened the first time to me, when I first said to myself, hey, he's not a bad, you know, well, he's kind of a bad guy, but he's interesting and he's somewhat sympathetic. That's when I kind of went, wow, this was a very effective way to tell this story, because Martin can manipulate your feelings and do it honestly.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and the best example of that is about the Kingslayer backstory on Jamie, and that's the perfect example of how Martin creates a perception of a character with some facts, and everybody perceives him that way. But then once you get his side of the story, you have a different view of those events. I mean, he's called the Kingslayer because he stabbed the old king in the back, even though he was part of his honor garb and was supposed to keep him safe. He killed the king, and so everybody views him as this guy that betrayed his vows and his, you know, his honor is nothing and all that stuff. But Jaime knew that the king had been plotting with the pyromancers to basically blow up the whole city and kill everybody at King's Landing, and the only person who could stop it was him because he was the only one who knew. And therefore, he acted. He killed the king, and then afterwards, he hunted down the other pyromancer leaders and killed them. And he saved everybody in King's Landing, but no one will ever know that. No one would ever believe him because no one else heard those events, those plots happening. And no one will ever, you know, the other people alive or dead, they can't testify about it. So he has to just live with the shame of this Kingslayer thing without anybody, you know, understanding you know, why he did what he really did, but he knows he did the right thing.
And is that something that emerged in the most recent book?
Of the last couple. Okay. As he traveled around with Brian on the, you know, when she broke him out of jail, Catelyn Stark let him out, and he and Brian were traveling down the river and trying to get King's Landing. Some of that came out in his thought, because there were some chapters of his perspective there. But then also, like, you know, then they get captured by Vargo Hoat, and they cut his hand off and all that stuff. And that's when you really get more and more about him. He becomes much more sympathetic after they cut his hand off.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, and he also killed the king. But from the very beginning, it always seemed to me that the other leaders wanted that done. And they would insult him for being the one to do it. But they had to have it done.
Right, well, but they all would have done it too.
Yeah, right.
But the difference was that he was sworn to protect the king with his life, and so when he did it, people were like, well, we know what that means.
Yeah, right. So, the other thing about structure real quick was, and I thought this was interesting, was he was writing the, I guess, fourth book, which is the Crows.
A Feast for Crows.
Yeah. It originally wasn't going to be A Feast for Crows, I believe. And he was writing that one, and it got to be so long, and it had been about 6 years, I think, since the Storm of Swords came out, that he finally, under pressure from the publisher and the readers and everybody, he just needed to wrap that book up. And so he decided to break it off at a certain point and publish it as only a certain set of point of view characters. It's different, I believe, from all the others, right?
It's not like the others.
It's only I'm looking at the numbers here. It's only 46 chapters compared to 82 for A Storm of Swords, because it leaves out several, like Jon Snow and Tyrion, right? I mean, two of the most important and popular characters.
Sure.
You don't get any of in A Feast for Crows. From what I remember from reading A Feast for Crows, which was about 6 or 7 years ago now, hard to believe, it was mostly, the thing that stuck out to me, it was mostly Cersei Lannister.
Yes, yes.
It was sort of her rise and fall, wasn't it?
It was her, and then there was Sam going to the tower, and then there was Arya going to, you know, the House of Black and White to eventually learn how to become an assassin or whatever. So
yeah, yeah. But it was that Cersei's kind of rise as the real power, and then just sort of screwing everything up and nearly destroying everything that stands out in my mind about that book. So he had to do that sort of by necessity rather than by design. One can only imagine how long Volume 4 would have been if he'd been able to include, you know, everybody and everything. So,
well, but this is what happened then. A Storm of Swords came out in 2000, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A Feast for Crows came out in 2005. So then you had some characters that you, from 5 years later, A Dance with Dragons came out in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So then there were some characters, like Jon and Tyrion, we didn't hear anything from for 11 years.
Right, right.
And so those of us who appreciate this series can't wait to see what happens next. That's a long time.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, you last saw Tyrion in a rather compromising position at the end of A Storm of Swords. And then 11 years later, you find out what he does next. So
that's right.
All right. Well, let's see. The plot. We kind of have to trust Martin that he knows what he's doing. It does seem to be growing in the telling, as Tolkien said. You know, Tolkien famously said of Lord of the Rings that the tale grew in the telling, and he didn't have a quarter of it on what on Martin.
Sure. Well, and there's a real fear here for me, who reads a lot of these kind of series, and the fear is the Robert Jordan problem.
Yeah.
Which is where he kept growing it and growing it and growing it exponentially, and it got to a point where he could write a 1,000-page book and the whole plot moved forward 2 inches because it was too big, too cumbersome. And so there's a fear of that with Martin. I think he's got a much better grasp on it and he knows where he's going, so he's gonna, but at some point you'd love to see the plot starting to come back together, you know, instead of keep expanding outward. You'd love to see plot things come back and intersect together.
Well, as one example, I mean, all along here we've had Daenerys off doing her own thing, and we've just had to trust that it had anything to do with Westeros, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we book after book, you keep thinking, well, any time now Daenerys is going to show up and kick butt. No, she's just off.
Even in the most recent book, you think this is it. This is the time she's going to take the army and take the dragons and march over there. She doesn't. She stays in over another continent and you know, deals with stuff over there. And people from Westeros are coming to her and trying to intersect, you know, with her plot line. But you know, she's off doing stuff over there and not directly interfering in events at Westeros yet.
It also makes me wonder if the ending that he had planned for a little 3-book thing will still be enough or will work sufficiently for this grandiose saga that it's become.
There's a lot of theories about where he's going and how it's going to end or whatever. It's clearly, you know, things have been getting bad in Westeros for a while, and it's clearly going to get much worse before it gets better. Civilization's been breaking down. There's been a succession of different rulers who are doing a terrible job, including Cersei. She was terrible as running the kingdom. And you know, the North's basically falling apart. A lot of places, you know, they haven't been able to harvest crops because there's been so much warfare and all the peasants have been, you know, killed, enslaved, overrun, that kind of stuff. The crops have been ruined. So there's not going to be enough food when winter comes. And then, you know, when winter gets bad, that the undead from the North are going to show up at some point and the wall may or may not hold them.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, you're right. It's not going to get much better. It's going to get worse before it gets better. And it's interesting. It's one of those political type stories there as well, like you're describing, where everybody knows what needs to be done, but the political situation won't allow it, and so you can just see the whole thing going off the tracks, you know, because they're too busy fighting among themselves to. It's like a game of. it's like what was the. A game of fiscal cliff.
Sure. Well, but it's like they keep sending these messages from the wall down to King's Landing saying, send armies, send men, send people. You know, bad stuff's coming. We need help. And they're laughing at them like, we're not getting any political gain out of sending you reinforcements.
Exactly.
Why would we do that?
Right, exactly. There's no immediate gain to be had in sending and worrying about tomorrow's problem. And it's you can just see that the limited nature of the views of the people that they are so wrapped up in today's do I rule, do you rule, that they can't see tomorrow when it doesn't really matter who's ruling because everybody's going to be dead.
That's right.
So so where do you think this is going? I mean, and do you think it's going the same place it was going when he started?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know where he thought it was going to go. I think, eventually Daenerys is coming back to Westeros. The dragons will be more full grown and she'll have some level of control over them. She'll have her army of the eunuch soldiers, the Unsullied. She'll have some other people at her disposal, some other forces. I mean, I think at the end of the most recent book, she meets the a Khalasar of the riders, the barbarian riders that she was married into. And, you know, you think, you know, she may reconquer them or whatever, and maybe they'll come with her too, the Dothraki. So at some point she's going to come back to the kingdom, and then, you know, she's going to bring a whole bunch of people with her, and she's going to start kicking rear end and taking names. But the other part is, I really think that the undead, the others, those things are at some point. I think the wall's going to fall, and I think they're going to come through the north and basically kill everybody they can get their hands on, and the the Black Brothers and the Watch are going to have to keep falling back and falling back, and I think they're. It's going to be kind of a rear guard action where they're falling back and falling back, and the undead are basically wiping out everybody in the north. And eventually, they're going to have assistance from the south. And so my theoretical ending is that, Daenerys with the dragons and her armies come up and eventually help them, fight off the undead and get them back, vanquish them or whatever. The dragons, theoretically, the dragons versus the others is the big end scene.
Yeah. And originally it would have made sense for the ending sort of wrap up to have been Daenerys to marry Rob. But that ain't going to happen.
Probably not.
No.
Although, several people that have come back from the dead already, and he might not smell very good, but
yeah,
it's awesome,
exactly. So we're left with Jon and Arya and I guess Tyrion, and that's not who I think are the three most interesting characters, by the way. But
well, and I'm going to spoil stuff for people who haven't finished the most recent book, but I got to say it. At the end of that book, Jon Snow gets stabbed a bunch of times.
Oh boy!
So there's some theories here that I have about that. I need to say them.
Okay.
Jon Snow is clearly an important character, and people love him. I mean, he's a lot of people's favorite character.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets stabbed a bunch by some other guys on the Watch who are upset because he makes a treaty with the Wildlings and lets a bunch of them through the wall to help because he knows they're not the real enemy. He knows the others are the real enemy, so he has to make a deal with the Wildlings to help them reinforce the North against the others. And so the Black Brothers stab him at the end because they have this kind of very limited view about, it's us against the Wildlings. They don't see the big picture that the Wildlings are, nothing, and that the others are the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you're left with this thing. You don't know whether he lives or dies at the end of that book. And so there's a couple of theories. One is, he's dead, which would be a very George Martin thing to do, to take a character and build him up for five books and then kill him and everybody's left missing him. But because of where he is and who's around him, there are two ways he will come back in the next book. Maybe he lived from five stab wounds or whatever, but say he doesn't. He could either, A, come back as a white, because theoretically there's the Cold Hands character that helps Sam and them at one point and then helps Bran when he goes north of the wall, and we believe that's Eddard Stark theoretically. Potentially, and so maybe the Starks have some kind of resistance to becoming a white, and he would still be know who he was, but he would, be kind of basically indestructible. We've seen the Lightning Lord guy, Beric Dondarrion, be brought back to life multiple times by this priest of light named Thoros of Myr. Dondarrion keeps getting killed by different people in battles, and then Thoros breathes the life back into him, and he's come back seven or eight times supposedly from fatal wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Red Priestess, the one that hangs around King Stannis, Melisandre, is up there at the wall with Jon at the time of the stabbing. She could run out there and breathe life back into him, and he could come back the same way that Beric Dondarrion did. So those are kind of he could be dead, but also I think there's two potential ways Jon could come back and still lead the resistance in the north or whatever. But clearly the others are getting ready to attack, and the fact that he got stabbed in the middle of a camp full of both Wildlings and Men of the Watch means that probably those people are going to start attacking each other, and there's going to be kind of a civil war on the wall at the same time the bad guys attack, which is a real kind of a storm. But
yeah, and that's kind of the way Martin likes to do it, is to have all kind of things hit at once and it swirls around. So well, see, the thing about coming back from the dead like that, though, is that we were gonna address the question, is anyone safe? But I mean, when you can bring them back one way or another, although I'm not sure I want my favorite character to be a zombie, but you know, but
well, and it's like the Catelyn Stark thing. I mean, you know, they and that's the best. We'll talk about the TV show in a minute, but the whole thing where she dies at the wedding, and then at the end of the book she comes back, you know, and they have the whole scene where people see her and the bandits are working for her, hunting down the Freys and stuff. You know, it's the idea that she's this kind of zombie and she's come back from the dead seeking vengeance, is that's scary. And you know, you're not sure how much of a good guy she really is anymore.
Yeah. But. Well, but she, from the very beginning, though, she's always been, you know, a quote-unquote a good guy. But on the other hand, you know, she wasn't always working along the same lines.
No, she caused a lot of problems.
With her behavior. Well, we didn't really address this. What are your favorite families and characters, and have it, has it changed as things have changed going along? We talked a little bit about Jamie becoming more sympathetic. What other characters or situations have happened that have caused you to maybe reevaluate who you're rooting for or against?
I mean, I guess I'd have to say that Tyrion's my favorite character. I mean, I always liked him. I love the part where he's Hand of the King and he's, you know, running things in King's Landing and preparing for the attack on the city and stuff. I really enjoy that. And I think, you know, he moves on in the later books and he's out looking out for himself, but he's still, you know, a good person. He takes care of other people. He does, you know, tries to sacrifice himself to save other people. And, you know, he ends up in some pretty cruddy circumstances, but he, you know, he keeps a good, keeps his head about him and, makes him very likable. You know, I think, I mean, I've come to like Jamie a little bit just because the whole, he views himself as this knight, you know, he only wanted to be a knight. He only wanted to, you know, do good deeds and help people. And he got politically, because of who his dad was, he got basically dragged into the, you know, being in the White Knights, the Kingsguard. And, you know, then he got a whole stuck with this whole Kingslayer thing, so nobody trusts him, and nobody views him, you know, the way historically that he would love to be viewed, which is one of the great knights in history. Mm-hmm. But especially since his hand got cut off, and he's you know, basically said, I've, you know, done with my sister, that kind of stuff. He is a much more likable character. And so it's going to be interesting to see where he goes with it, where his character goes.
Yeah, I'll say this about Tyrion. I think you make an interesting point there about how, when he was in control of King's Landing for a while. That really is a great example of your loyalties getting stretched, because that's when Stannis was coming down with his fleet to attack, right?
Yep.
And under normal circumstances, you know, your sympathies probably would have been with Stannis, because he really was the rightful heir. You know, everything else aside, if it's just looking at the mathematics of it, Stannis was really the rightful heir, and the Lannisters at King's Landing deserved to get their butts kicked. But Stannis was kind of a jerk, and he's thrown in with this sort of, you know, the Scientology of the of the Martin world. And, sure. And on the other hand, the leader of the defense of the city we don't like is the character we like the best, just about. So, you know, you're kind of left almost rooting for King's Landing in that battle, even though you don't want to.
Sure.
So it's really interesting how he turns the tables on your own rooting interests and your own feelings in a conflict like that. That really impressed me.
And you have the other character, the Onion Knight, was on the side of Stannis in that battle. So you have two guys that, you know, he's kind of a sympathetic guy. You like him. He's a good person stuck on Stannis' side. So you have this view where, you know, people are on opposite sides, somebody's going to lose. So,
Yeah, the way that he plays with your loyalties, he can manipulate them to a certain degree. He can build characters up and make them, you know, make you see the good things about them and cheer for them. And then he puts them in a situation where you're like, well, I don't know if I want to cheer for them in that situation, and I'm not sure exactly, you know, what to do now. Though it was interesting, the one character that really was making all the right decisions, everything was going his way, was Rob, until he made the one bad decision about who to marry. And then that one decision brought everything crashing down. You know, I never saw I think that was probably the one thing that happened in all the books that surprised me the most, was that I never saw Rob and the Starks being utterly defeated and cast down, and even their home, you know, city, their castle, yeah, all overrun.
Yeah,
and overrun by, you know, this is another thing we're going to talk about the TV show, and as we're moving into the last quarter of our show here, that I go ahead and introduce that as well. That in the TV show, I thought it was fascinating how the characters are written the same, pretty much the same ways in the books, but yet because you can see them and interact with mm-hmm. them more in the show, they make different impressions on you. Some of them pretty much the same. I mean, I think Cersei comes across about the same.
Yep.
But and Tyrion, it comes across about the same, which is very good. But like the what's his name that from the Iron Islands
Theon Greyjoy.
Theon, yeah. Theon in the books is bad enough, but the actor did such a great job of making him just completely unlikable in the TV show. And then he almost gets a little sympathetic for a moment when you see how mean his family is to him. And then he turns around and loses that because he's so incompetent and such a boob when he goes back and tries to impress his own army. I mean, you know, things that play out in the book when you actually see them happen, like when his own soldiers knock him out and are like, yep, all right, you know, let's yep. carry him back to the king. I mean, that was very impressive to me as and it was interesting how different they can come across while being the same characters when you can see them in a visual medium.
Yep. And the TV show is great. I love it. It's very true to the books in a lot of ways. They can't do everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, you'd love to see more special effect kind of stuff. But, I mean, they're already spending a gazillion dollars filming all those different locations with a zillion characters. But I love the sets, the plots, the costumes, the way they're doing everything. And I think you're right. The casting was great. The characters really come through. Mm-hmm. The other thing about the TV show that makes it good is they're not limited by the point of view chapter thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are conversations that take place between characters that never had chapters at all or never had chapters in that book. So, for example, in the first season, there's a great scene between King Robert Baratheon and Cersei where they talk about how their marriage holds the kingdom together while they laugh at that idea. And that's a great scene, and it's really well done, and I think it adds something, you know, to the story, and I enjoyed that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that there are certain characters that come across, I don't want to say better, but more vividly in the TV sure. show. And there's plenty that don't. I mean, like I said, I think that, you know, as you know, for those that have seen the show but not read the books, why are you listening to this? But for those that have, I mean, Tyrion, again, I keep going back to him because I think he's the most vividly drawn character of the whole thing. Tyrion, as you know, you look at the show and say, wow, he's a great character, is a great actor playing him, you know, won the Emmy for it and everything. Yeah, you know what? In the books, he's just the same way. He's just as vivid, just as well portrayed in the writing. So that's about the same. Same with, you know, Rob and his mother and Eddard Stark and all that. The ones that have really jumped out to me, and I think Daenerys as well, is about even between the book and the TV show, would you say?
Sure.
But the two that come to my mind immediately as being more vivid in the TV show, I mentioned Theon. I think Theon is more colorful, and you just can feel all his smarminess in the TV show that maybe doesn't come across quite as much in the book. But also Littlefinger.
Yes.
Because in the books, Littlefinger is sort of a cipher. You never really know exactly what he has going on. And they maintain that in the TV show. But he's, I'm not sure if it's that you can actually see him with your eyes, you know, rather than just feeling the things he's doing in the book, so to speak. But the actor that plays him is very good, I think. And I feel like they've actually expanded his role a little bit in the TV show. Is that just me, or is that the case, do you think?
No, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that he does in the books that's kind of off camera.
Right.
You know? So you can't see it, you can't appreciate it, and they add that stuff on the screen in the TV show, and it mm-hmm. you know, I think it adds something.
I would be remiss while we're talking about the characters, too, if I did not address the one that drove me the craziest early on. And that would be Eddard Stark. Now, when I saw having read the books, right, when I saw that Sean Bean was cast to play Eddard Stark, I laughed and laughed and laughed. But I couldn't I couldn't tell anybody why. So I would say, yes, isn't it great that this really fun, good actor that was in Lord of the Rings, you know, and James Bond and the Sharps series and all that. Yes, it's great that he plays sort of the Aragorn character, right? No, he's Boromir. Yeah. You know, he's still Boromir. I'm sorry. You don't know it yet.
Yeah. Knowing that was coming at the end of the first season of the TV show, mm-hmm. and waiting for everybody's reaction was so great.
Exactly. I mean,
when they're like, oh, they're not going to kill him. He's the main guy. He's got to save everybody.
This is his show, right? This is Sean Bean's fantasy show. Like, no. He's basically a guest star for the first season. And, you know, so I was looking to see who was playing Jon, who was playing Tyrion and Arya, because I'm like, those are your stars. Those are the ones you're going to be seeing for a few years. Sean Bean is going to be on to the next movie in a few in a few months, you know. So that was kind of funny. Because I've always said that other than Sharp, you know, that Napoleonic series he does in for Britain, other than that, every character he plays either a bad guy or a good guy that dies at the end. Or if he's a bad guy, he dies at the end. So he maintained his record there. Let me think.
What here. I want to say is season 3 starts in a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited. And they split it up into two seasons, so book 3 will be 2 TV seasons long. Mm-hmm. We'll get part of it this year, part of it next year, which is tough, but it is a huge, thick book, as you said earlier, and there's a lot there. And I just can't wait until we get to the wedding, the Red Wedding.
Oh, Lord.
Because that will be such a gigantic scene, and people will absolutely freak out that, you know, Rob and Caitlin get killed.
That's got to be the end of the next season, hasn't it?
It has to. My theory is, there's a couple places they could stop at the end of, you know, this season. I think the wedding doesn't take place at the end of the next book.
No.
I mean, because you got all the other stuff going on. We somewhere in there we have the king's wedding to Marjorie Tyrell, you know, the young king that we all hate.
Yeah, Joffrey.
Joffrey, who's so good in the TV show too, is being an absolute schmuck.
Yeah.
But then also, so you have that, and you have so his wedding, or he dies, and Sansa Stark escapes. You have the Red Wedding. You have stuff going on with Daenerys, and then also you have the big scene where she gets the Unsullied, and the dragons burn the slavers and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you have the scene, you have scenes in the North with Jon Snow. Mm-hmm. He's out joining the wildlings, falls in love with the girl, you know, eventually escapes, warns about the attack on the wall, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of that coming in this season, and it's going to be great to see.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they break it apart. I'm glad that they're breaking it, as far as I've heard, right, into two seasons, because yes. One of the concerns is that the, when they started out making the show, you thought, well, you know, he's got plenty of time to write the next couple of books and wrap things up. But you have to remember, this is George R. R. Martin. It's not plenty of time for him, because there's actually a fear kind of going around now. You know, you mentioned the fear that he might die, and that's certainly true. But there's also the concern that he won't have finished book 7 by the time book 6 has been adapted for the show, and they don't know what to do with the show next.
That's right. So would he give him some kind of manuscript that's partway done? Would they take the show in a different direction? You can't do that. You
no.
can't have the book and the TV show go to a different ending. So I genuinely don't know where they're going to go with it.
And you can't have the TV show spoil the ending of the book.
No.
So, I mean, you got to think the book has to come out before the TV show.
It has to, but it creates logistical problems. I mean, he's got 2 more books to read, and the pace he's going, he's not going to make it.
Yeah, when do you think number 6 will be out? Has there been any indication?
Listen, I look on the internet all the time about that kind of stuff, and I haven't seen anything, you know, legitimate. He hasn't said anything. The publishers, you know, are noticeably not going to say anything after the last couple of books. There were several false start kind of things where they put it on Amazon, and then it was like, oh, you know, 2 years later the book came out. So they're not going to go there. I think, you know, we'll be lucky if we get Winds of Winter like in 2014. That would be lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so that's a, you know, maybe a year and a half from now. And that will be, again, be ahead of his recent pace.
Yeah. And it would be, it would be just on pace with the TV show, or it would be like one ahead, I think. Right.
Right. So they'd have time to do that one, but then, you know, he'd have to write the next book in a year or less for them to be able to do the TV show.
Yeah.
And so you worry that he's going to screw it up, take 5 years to write that book. Meanwhile, the TV show, they had to stop filming. The cast is going on to do other stuff, and they'll never be able to film the last season of the TV show, which would be a real tragedy. The other thing that scares me to death is that he's going to pull Robert Jordan. He's going to die before he finishes filming the series, before he finishes writing the books.
Yeah, he's not a young, spry, healthy dude either. You know, he's an older guy. So
no, you know, so it's a. Some of my friends who enjoy the series are actually kind of bitter about it because he spends so much time on the TV show and going to awards things and traveling around the world, meeting with people and book signings and stuff, that we just want to lock him in his room and make him finish writing the series because if he doesn't, he's going to die and we're not going to know. And then you get into this whole thing of like, you know, is there going to be something like Dune where we discover the manuscript in his safe deposit box, which I'm skeptical about, but I read that anyway. So, you know, we don't want to go there. We want him to write the ending, and he needs to write it before we're bringing him back as a white to write the ending.
I got to say, you said that about the Dune thing. I've got to say for my regular listeners out there, you know, I did a panel 2 years ago at Dragon Con with Kevin Anderson and Kevin J. Anderson, as he goes by, and I was asking him about that, and I was like, so you found the whole thing in the safety deposit box? Like, well, there were some boxes in a garage, and I said, I'm going to fly back to St. Louis tomorrow and look in my garage and see if I can find any lost manuscripts, you know, or anything. I was kind of just giving him crap about it, but yeah, you read that. You and I are going to talk about Dune, too, in the future. That's why this is kind of on our mind.
Sure.
We'll do that show coming up soon, but yeah, it is kind of horrifying to think that you could end up having to get somebody else to finish the story if they would even do that. You know, they're doing that with the Jordan books, right?
Yeah, so, well, somebody else already did it, so it's done. And honestly, I stopped reading. So
is that series done?
I believe so. But honestly, again, I didn't. It is done as far as I know. I stopped reading at a certain point when Jordan was still writing it because he got so far off the rails, kind of.
Yeah.
About 9 books in or whatever.
So. real quick, the other thing I was going to say about Eddard Stark, and I forgot, was that, you know, one of the things that's always jumped out to me about this whole series is that when you read the first book the first time, you assume that Eddard Stark is the hero, the good guy, the guy you are supposed to cheer for. And so when he makes various decisions in it, one after another, I kind of try to rationalize what he's doing. Like, well, he's doing the honorable thing. He's the good guy. He's doing the right thing. And he will be rewarded for making the right decisions. He will be rewarded for doing the right good thing. And the lesson that Martin is teaching us here is if you do the right and honorable thing, it may look in the short term like you suffer some losses, but ultimately you are rewarded by nature and the universe for doing the honorable thing. Was that the lesson he was teaching us with Eddard Stark?
No.
No. He was teaching us the lesson, don't be stupid.
Yes.
I mean, everything that Ned Stark does, and I mean, almost every decision he makes in the first book leads to the ruin of his family and his own death.
That's right. And it's because, you know, he's descended into a pit of vipers, but he wants to hold himself above it and say, I'm honorable. I'm not going to play that game. I don't act like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. You're risking your family's life and your life by acting that way.
Yes.
And you need to, you know, go in it with open eyes and say, you know, this isn't something we're going to be honorable. We're going to fight to the death with all these people in this room. I'm not going to trust anybody, and I'm going to do whatever I have to do, no matter how brutal, to protect myself and my family.
Yeah, the lesson of the first book really is pragmatism trumps idealism.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he wants to get in the mud and not get dirty. And Cersei basically tells him at one point, she says, you win or you die.
That's right.
And he's like, no, I'm not going to win or die. I'm just going to be good. And you're like, no, you're going to be dead.
He was good.
Yeah, he was good right till they chopped his head off. That was the thing. When I went back and read the first book a second time, and I didn't enjoy it nearly as much. Because the first time through, I'm like, come on, Ned, take care of business. And then the second time through, I was like, you idiot, you moron, what are you doing? Don't do that. No, I just couldn't stand him the second time through.
Yeah, I agree. You just you read it again and you keep thinking, boy, that was really not smart based on future
events. Based on what we know now, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, man. So.
But he also, the other part that's frustrating is he had a chance to prevent all this terrible stuff from happening.
Yes.
He could have allied himself with Robert's younger brother, Renly, mm-hmm. grabbed a bunch of soldiers, taken control of King Joffrey, held the kingdom in his hand, held it together. He'd have been a much better ruler. Things would have been under control. There wouldn't have been this famine, civil war, pestilence thing going on, and we'd be in a much better situation, but he didn't. And now he's dead, and the kingdom's, going to hell in a handbasket.
And he's also the poster boy for what happens when you find out dangerous information about your enemy, and instead of, mailing out ravens with the information ahead of time and then hiding, you instead go to the villain and say, I know all your secrets, villain. What are you going to do about it? And the villain says, I'm going to kill you.
Well, no, he says, you must retreat, because that would be what he would do.
Yeah.
We must walk away. No, there's another option.
There's another option that you haven't considered here, which is that, we just kill you. So, wow. Yeah, that just drove me nuts reading it again. I couldn't even continue a second read through. It is one of those things. I know that there are people, and maybe you, I'm not sure, that can read these books multiple times. I can't. I like to read it once to find out all the shocking developments, but I just can't go back and revisit that stuff, because once it's been emotionally banged on my head, I just can't I'm like, I know what happened, I get it, and then I'm just
I really enjoy reading it again, because I think there's so much there's so much that happens, and there's so much for the first time I'm reading it, I'm like devouring a great meal, and I'm going fast, and I can't wait to see what happens, and I'm turning the pages, and so then I read it again later, and I go slow, and I really go, wow, I really missed that nuance in the first book about this character, what's happening over here. And so the other thing is, there's so much going on that before each new book comes out, I reread the entire series. So then and I finish it right before the new book comes out. So then I'm mentally prepared, and I remember where everybody is and what was going on, so I can start the new book at the right point.
Whereas I have no clue.
It's just too – I love reading it, and it will bother me to read it again, so I'll enjoy it. But it's too complex to just pick it up and, go with it.
Well, I know it is. I'm living proof, because I start the new one, and I go, I have no idea what's going on. What's this person doing? Why are they in this situation? I can't remember. It's only been 6 years, or like you said, 11 years in one case, or a couple of cases, so – Man, I also wanted to mention right quick as we're kind of moving toward our ending here, there have been various other adaptations. There's like a comic book adaptation, although I'm thinking at this point you've got the novels, you've got the TV series. Do you really need a comic book? I guess there's something they could do different in the comic book. I don't know what it could be, but there is the comic adaptation. And also there's one other thing, and I'm not sure. I don't know if you and I have ever talked about this. But there's the Dunk and Egg series. Have you read those?
I have. I've read some of that. And I've read – one of the other things that he wrote that I really enjoy is The Winter Dragon. Okay. Have you ever read that?
No.
It's more – you should get it. It's a children's book.
Okay.
And I read it to my kids. It's probably, I don't know, like a seventh grade reading level or something. But it tells a story of a long ago battle in the north, and this girl who dreamed of the ice dragon, I think it's called.
Okay.
It's good. It's worth reading. So I've read the Dunk and Egg stuff, and that's kind of entertaining. But again, he's writing that stuff, and I'm like, put it down and go back to the main book. Man, you're killing me.
For whatever days of your life are left after you finish book 7, then you can go do this. But the Dunk and Egg thing is neat just because it's sort of set a couple hundred years before game, the Ice and Fire stories, I believe. And it's sort of, it's like a hedge knight and his little kid that's in his care who actually is somebody much more important than he, than you first realize, I believe. So, and is he like the young version of a character that shows up later, or is he just like a ancestor or something?
No, I think he's a marginally referred to hedge knight kind of guy in one of the books.
But I mean the kid though.
I think he's Pig. He shows up at some of the events that are in the books. I'm not sure whether he grows into a character or not. I can't remember.
I was thinking he's a Targaryen.
That makes sense.
I'm thinking he's a Targaryen that's like an heir that was lost or something. And
sure.
So who knows?
As you say that, at one point, Aemon Targaryen, the one that's on the wall, the master that works with Jon Snow and them, at one point, I think he talks about his brother Egg.
Okay.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, that sounds, it just seems like he had some connection. So, okay. Well, any other thoughts to sort of conclude our journey through the
I'm excited to see where it goes. I'm excited to see where the books and the TV show go, and I know some people were so frustrated with the pace that it's driving them crazy, and in particular all the books, book four is the least good, A Feast for Crows. That's the one with all the Cersei chapters and the Sam chapters and stuff. So of all the books, that's the one that is the least enjoyable. The least major things happen, and the least you don't have. There's no Tyrion or Jon Snow. People miss that. So that's the one book where you're like, okay, come on, let's keep it moving. Mm-hmm. And so we, that book was in the middle of an 11-year stretch where that was the only book we got. So I think that's turned off some people. But I can't wait. I'll be at the bookstore the day the next one comes out and get it and read it, and I'll be there on March 13th when the TV show comes back.
Yeah, and I guess at some point I'm going to have to read A Dance with Dragons. I've had it, and I put it off and put it off, and it may be what you said, that the 2005 book sort of dimmed my enthusiasm a little bit. I didn't hate that book like some people did. I know some friends that were saying it was terrible. I liked it okay. And I love Arya, one of my favorite characters, so I was excited to get some more of her.
But it's also like the third book was awesome.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So good, so great. So then having the fourth book followed up, the fourth book was just okay.
Right.
It's not awesome. So I think the newest book is much better than that book.
Okay.
So. And the other thing that he does that you'll appreciate is he stays with the limited point of view of the characters that weren't in the fourth book, but there's some point in the middle of the fifth book when he switches to everybody.
Back to everybody.
We're back to current events, basically.
Right, right. So that really, so Dance with Dragons really is almost like two books. It's the other half of book four, and then it's a book five, right?
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah, so. Okay, well, if you have read the books, watched the shows, then hopefully you gained something from our conversation. And if you haven't, what the crap were you doing listening to this? Yeah. Good Lord. But
Big mistake,
yes. We've ruined everything for you here. John, thanks for coming on. We'll sign off now for another episode of the White Rocket Podcast. I want to mention really quickly that Sentinels Metal God, my most recent novel that came out through White Rocket, it actually hit number one on the New Pulp bestseller list a couple of weeks ago as we were recording this, and I was very excited about that. And I just want to thank all of my readers out there and listeners for getting it and making it number one. That's, I believe, the first time I've had a number one, which is pretty remarkable since that's volume seven. We're just talking about a seven-volume series, and that's volume seven. And by the time this is out, we will be about a week or two away from the release of my next book, which is called a new series I'm doing called The Shattering. And the first book is called Legion One, Lords of Fire. And it's more of a military science fiction with some supernatural stuff woven into it. And it has a very definite connection to my Hawk novel. So if you read Hawk, and also to Lucian, they all kind of tie together. I'm sort of weaving together this separate universe that includes both a kind of a supernatural element like Lucian, but also a kind of a military sci-fi element like Hawk. This is sort of the series that's going to tie everything together and give you that backstory. So look for Lords of Fire coming out probably in early February. So, all right. Well, thanks again, John, and the rocket's going to get on out of here, and so we will see you guys down the road. Thanks, John.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to doing it again.
All right.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.